Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro-Libertate Radio, a full-throttle, no-holds-barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gray.
Drop what you're doing! Siraj Omar was at a local grocery store trying to read the ingredients label on yogurt. He asked a store clerk if it contained any pork, something his religion forbids him to eat. Instead, the clerk asked him the question, "Are you Muslim?" Omar, who speaks in a thick Somalian accent, told him, "Yes." The man took a few steps back, then, according to Omar, began a tirade. "Muslims are bad people. Muslims are terrorists. They are killers. They are evil people, and I don't believe in your religion or your faith." Omar was stunned. The 37-year-old refugee from Somalia is the father of four and a U.S. citizen. He's lived in this country for 15 years, works as a janitor at a Kansas City elementary school, and is a regular customer at the grocery. Still, he understood the man's feelings toward Muslims. It was everywhere after 9/11. But now, many area Muslims, the area they're referring to here in this Kansas City Star article is, of course, Kansas City, fear that anti-Islam attitudes have reignited with the controversy over building a mosque, it's not a mosque, two blocks from Ground Zero in New York City. The national debate over the mosque, oh boy, can you call this a debate? It's an irrational tirade, but it's not a debate. Nobody's debating anything. One side professes the invincible sovereignty of hurt feelings, and the other side points out that the Constitution, the law, fundamental decency and logic are all on the side of those who defend the use of private property by law-abiding U.S. citizens. On the other, this isn't a debate, because one side has nothing to offer the rational among us. So it's not a debate. To continue here. The national supposed debate over the mosque, a 13-story, $100 million project, was heightened when President Barack Obama said that those wanting to build the Islamic Center and mosque have the constitutional right to religious freedom. We're debating this now? Later, he clarified that he was talking only about the right to build the center and not the wisdom of doing so close to Ground Zero. On Wednesday, as the political rhetoric intensified, the president wasn't backing down, firmly stating that he had no regrets about stepping into the firestorm over religious rights. Well, he should regret not saying something intelligible and principled, seeing as how he did inject himself into this issue. But it was already something that had become a national issue because Newt Gingrich had injected himself into it. Last I checked, Newt Gingrich, who has no current elected office, has never represented anybody in any of the affected jurisdictions in New York. He's a figure of national prominence, largely on the strength of his own shamelessness, but he's never represented anybody in New York. So it had already become a national issue, but that's not a reason for the president, whoever he might be, to get involved in the matter, particularly in such an equivocal fashion as Barack Obama did. Anti-Muslim feelings are running strong again in America, with some critics equating Islamic extremists with the Muslim religion. Others oppose building the mosque so close to what they consider the World Trade Center's hallowed ground. It's interesting how that supposedly hallowed ground is desecrated by the presence of people hawking chintzy, overpriced memorabilia. It's not desecrated by the existence of strip clubs or by the presence of an existing mosque, which has been there since 1970, or the fact that at the very site where this YMCA-style Muslim center would be built, there are worship services that take place five times a day. So you're not dealing here with desecration. Once again, you're dealing with people who are irrationally devoted to nurturing their bottomless sense of directionless grievance. A recent CNN opinion research poll found that nearly 70% opposed the mosque plan, while only 29% approved. And a new Gallup poll Wednesday found more Americans disapprove, 37%, than approve, 20%, of Obama's recent comments. The 4 in 10 do not have an opinion. The poll also found Republicans seem to be paying closer attention to the matter than Democrats or independents. To Muslims who live thousands of miles from ground zero, the national arguments feel as if their very religious beliefs are under attack. Now, this story from Kansas City, the Kansas City Star, is interesting for a couple of reasons. The first of which is that this fellow, Sharij Omar, is from Somalia. He's a U.S. citizen. How did he end up in the United States? Well, he ended up in the United States because the United States intervened in Somalia in 1992 under the supposed authority of a United Nations Security Council resolution, supposedly as part of a humanitarian mission in order to get food to starving people that otherwise would have been intercepted by warlords in the region. The problem here, and this is something I actually went into detail describing and documenting in my book Global Gun Grab, the problem here is that by the time the United States, under the first President Bush, Bill Clinton gets the blame, but President Bush is the one who got us involved in this mess. By the time President Bush sent the Marines to go ashore in Somalia, under the glare of Klieg lights, that's something I find really interesting. The very first people ashore were the film crews for CNN. On the strength of a supposed authorizing resolution by the United Nations Security Council, by the time this all took place, the crisis of starvation was over. The food was getting to where it needed to go. So what happened is that within a year, what had become a humanitarian mission was redefined to become a nation-building mission. And part of that nation-building mission involved creating a central government to rule over an fractious collection of Somali tribes, none of which really wanted to be governed by the other. They had lived under the reign of Siad Barre, who, like Saddam Hussein, had been propped up by both Washington and Moscow. He'd played both superpowers off against each other and received a huge windfall in foreign aid from both Moscow and Washington as a result. He had created a huge, oppressive, tyrannical, corrupt, in other words, a central government in a country that didn't really want to have a government of any kind. And so after he was removed, and after his regime had fallen, and the warlords had taken over, there was a brief period, a scramble, a Hobbesian scramble for power, a war of all against all, that had more or less straightened itself out by the time the United States decided to butt in. But a year after we butted in, suddenly we were going to create a central government like the ones the Somalis had just gotten rid of. You know what? They didn't like that. They particularly didn't like the fact that they were going to be disarmed and the central government would have an effective monopoly on firepower. So they fought back. They fought back in the only way they could, through guerrilla warfare. And one result of that was the notorious Battle of Mogadishu, which was memorialized in Bowden's book Black Hawk Down, and the movie of the same name that was actually very inferior to the book, not surprisingly. But it was after this that the United States withdrew, and good on Bill Clinton for getting us out of Somalia. But after we withdrew, there was priority attention given to Somalis as refugees from that country. So part of the blowback, if you will, was cultural. First of all, you had a defeat for the Americans in Somalia. We had no business being there. If we hadn't been there, we wouldn't have gotten our butts kicked. But that catalyzed the resistance to American imperial foreign policy that was being whipped up by a fellow who had once been a subcontractor for Washington by the name of Osama bin Laden. If I remember correctly, at the time he was in Sudan, and he actually talked about the fact that the Somalis had kicked the United States out of their country as a victory in the cause of his global jihad. It's the sort of thing that happens when you get involved in fights that are none of your affair, and you do so badly, chances are there are going to be multiple negative returns, and this is a really good example of the same. One of the things that happened, by the way, is that some of the U.S.-trained and equipped Mujahideen from Afghanistan took a trip down to Somalia to fight next to their co-religionists. They had expertise that we had shared with them. I shouldn't say we. The government ruling us had shared with them as to how to bring down a helicopter gunship like a Black Hawk, because they'd used it to take down the Hind helicopters that the Soviet Union was running in Afghanistan. They managed to take out two of those Black Hawks, if I remember correctly, during the Battle of Mogadishu. So that's another example of blowback. But you end up with Somalis living in this country. They don't necessarily want to live here in places like Kansas and Minneapolis, some places in Maine. And now they're on the receiving end of unearned hostility because of the Muslim faith that they don't see fit to repudiate. We'll talk about this and other subjects on the other side of the break. Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. We'll be back in just a minute. Here's an interesting question with respect to the mosque at, so-called mosque at Ground Zero. If you were in charge of this project and knew that approximately 70% of Americans were against this location, would you look for another spot, even if you had the legal right to build there? Well, that would depend on whether or not I was willing to give the mob a veto over my exercise, lawful, peaceful exercise of property rights and freedom to religion. That's how I'd answer that question. If you're willing to give the mob a veto over the lawful, peaceful exercise of your rights, then by all means, defer to the wishes of the roiling, turbulent mob and allow yourself to be treated like a slave. You see, this is a principle that doesn't just apply to Muslims. This is a principle that applies to human beings. A more interesting question is this. If you have any commitment to the protection of individual liberty by law, are you willing to grant the mob a veto on matters of individual liberty for any reason? For any reason. Because if you're willing to grant the mob a veto in any circumstance, in principle, you're willing to grant the mob a veto in every circumstance. But we found ourselves in this country succumbing to one of the most pernicious variants of collectivism that's ever been propagated by the diseased mind of power-hungry people. And that is the notion that some people have the responsibility to immolate themselves on the altar of collective interest. You know, I'm not a disciple of Ayn Rand. I'm a disciple of Jesus of Nazareth, so obviously I can't be a disciple of Ayn Rand, although I admire at least some of her work product. There are people who say that at least some of what she wrote was plagiarized. I'm agnostic on that question. But I do find a great deal of value in her book, Anthem. It's a very small, very short book. It's the sort of thing that could be read in an hour and a half, and I'd recommend that anybody who hasn't read Anthem take an hour or so and read the book. But that book is all about the power that resides in the singular vertical pronoun, I, meaning the discrete individual, the sovereign individual. Now, I don't subscribe to the notion that selfishness is a virtue. That's something that Ayn Rand, of course, wrote about in your book, The Virtue of Selfishness. I don't happen to find that to be virtuous. I find that independence is a virtue, that self-assertion is a virtue, that a sense of self-ownership is a virtue. Selfishness, however, I consider to be at least morally dubious, because, once again, my moral manifesto is the Sermon on the Mount. And to the extent that Ayn Rand's teachings are reconcilable with the Sermon on the Mount, I find them worthwhile. But I remember, many decades ago when I read Atlas Shrugged. It's interesting. Is it possible for a person to have a crush on a fictional character who's not really described in the pages of a book? I had a crush on Dagny Taggart. I'm sure that's true of many millions of liberty-fixated men who've read that novel since it came out many, many decades ago. It's a badly overwritten novel. It could have been maybe a third its ultimate size and been much more valuable and had a much greater impact, I think, in terms of the message that it preached about the emancipated creative impulse and the way that our cultural collectivism militates against the same, and about the need every once in a while for those of us who cherish creativity and independence to withdraw from a system that leeches on us parasitically. Oh, if only we could find a real Galt's Gulch. In any case, there's a line, I can't remember where it's found, in Atlas Shrugged. I'm pretty sure it was in Atlas Shrugged, in which I think Dagny Taggart talks about the fact that we live in a society in which people preach that self-immolation is virtuous. Self-immolation means, in this context, a willingness to sacrifice one's rudimentary, indispensable rights in the name of the supposed collective interest. It's the sort of thing a suicide bomber does, isn't it? Somebody is willing to strap on a dynamite vest and ignite himself. Isn't he acting on behalf of a perverted sense of altruism? Which is to say, out of a sense of altruism, altruism, contrary to what most people believe, is not a virtue either. Altruism is not charity. The concept was not created by a Christian theologian. It was created by a pretty depraved individual. But altruism and selfishness are diametrically opposed yet mutually complementary vices. Altruism is the willingness to destroy the self in the interest of the collective. That's what a suicide bomber does, in a literal sense. Well, what people are saying, the collectivists, the Fox News, Republican Party, talk radio-aligned collectivists are saying, is that the only way that the Muslim imam and his followers who want to put up Park 51, Cordoba House, could display their virtue is by immolating themselves, making a funeral pyre of their liberties for the greater glory of the collective. There's a figure from, I believe it's the Fountainhead, by the name of Ellsworth Toohey, who's this chinless, chestless, nebbish of a loathsome excuse for a man, who was meant to symbolize the cringing yet bullying essence of cultural collectivism. That figure from the fiction of Ayn Rand was given tangible form in the person of Peter J. Johnson, Jr. Peter J. Johnson, you don't have to call me Mr. Johnson. My name is Peter J. Johnson, Jr. You can call me Pete. You can call me Petey. Never mind. It's a riff not many of you would understand. He's a legal advisor to Fox News. And in a recent broadcast of Fox and Friends, Mr. Johnson, he looks a little bit like Wallace Shawn, the voice actor from the film, oh, good grief, The Princess Bride. Inconceivable, that guy. You just made one of the classic blunders, that guy. He looks a little like Wallace Shawn. But he recently said that the Muslims in New York should give up their rights in order to demonstrate that they're good neighbors. We are proud that we are one of the few countries in the world which allows the free exercise of religion. Note that verb, allows. But when we resort to legalisms instead of common sense or compassion, when we invoke our First Amendment as a sword, not a shield, it means that we have lost sight of and broken faith with our national identity and strength. That's a horribly written paragraph. That's from a piece that was written to be performed on television. This is not something that was extemporized. I look for the day when this is no longer about politicians or pain or protest, but about neighbors becoming good neighbors, he said, with respect to the so-called Ground Zero Mosque. Thank God and our founders for the First Amendment, but God help us all if it all comes down to the need to rely upon it. Any American can assert a right. Great Americans, here's the punchline. Great Americans give up their rights to help those they share nothing else with but a love of this country. great Americans give up their rights. That's the poll quote. Give up your rights to prove you're a great American, you suspiciously bearded, dusky-skinned Muslim foreigners. Native-born Americans, sure, you have the right to do this, but if you're really a good American, then you'll give up that right, because that's the highest manifestation of Americanism, is repudiating your rights. Think about that for a second. And we'll be back in just a minute to discuss this and other subjects on Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call number. We'll be right back. Put this in the file marked, if they have it, they will use it. This is from the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Headline, high-tech carts will tell on Cleveland residents who don't recycle and they face $100 fine. It would be a stretch to say that Big Brother will hang out in Clevelanders' trash cans, but the city plans to sort through curbside trash to make sure residents are recycling and fine them $100 if they don't. The move is part of a high-tech collection system the city will roll out next year with new trash and recycling carts embedded with radio frequency identification chips, RFID, in other words, and barcodes. The chips will allow city workers to monitor how often residents roll carts to the curb for collection. If a chip shows a recyclable cart hasn't been brought to the curb in weeks, a trash supervisor will sort the trash for recyclables. Trash carts containing more than 10% recyclable material, is that 10% by weight or by volume? Who knows? It doesn't matter, because they're not going to be able to tell. Trash carts containing more than 10% recyclable material, as that 10% is identified through means yet to be specified, could lead to a $100 fine, according to Waste Collection Commissioner Ronnie Owens. Recyclables include glass, metal cans, plastic bottles, paper, and cardboard. Recycling, by the way, is fraudulent. It is an economic hoax. It, for the most part, is done for sacramental purposes rather than practical purposes. It's done in order to impress upon us a need for a collective consciousness regarding our supposed duties to the environment. If recycling, and there are forms of recycling that do work, by the way, and for the most part, those methods involve the profit motive. They don't involve mandatory, compulsive means. I've taken stuff over to a local recycler here in Payette, Idaho, and I've sold it to them. I've made a little bit of money that way. All that they needed to do was to say, okay, if you take your non-ferrous metals to this TVM recycling plant just outside the city limits of Payette, he'll pay you such and such a fee for such and such volume by weight of non-ferrous metals. So I collected them all up and went and made a little bit of money, enough to buy dinner for the family, that kind of thing. That works much better than coercion. But here we see where something is economically non-viable, and so, of course, the government in Cleveland is doubling down. City Council on Wednesday approved spending $2.5 million on high-tech carts for 25,000 households across the city, expanding a pilot program that began in 2007 with 15,000 households. The expansion will continue at 25,000 households a year until nearly all of the city's 150,000 residences are included. Existing carts might be retrofitted with the microchips. By the way, this is a good time, if you live in Cleveland, to learn how to disable an RFID chip. It's not that difficult. What you need to do is you need to find out where that chip is embedded and then find a way of disabling it. We're trying to automate our system to be more efficient, to be a more efficient operation, Owen said. This chip will assist us in doing our job better. Their job, of course, involves stealing revenue from the productive in order to lavish it on their fellow parasites. The chip-embedded carts are just starting to catch on elsewhere. The Washington, D.C. suburb of Alexandria, Virginia, earlier this year announced it would issue carts to check whether people are recycling. Some cities in England have used the high-tech trash carts for several years to weigh how much garbage people throw out. People are charged extra for exceeding allotted limits. That's the same England, by the way, whose prospective king, Charles, recently urged the population to snub the tub in order to avoid using too much water. That's an interesting suggestion. When I was in England about 20 years ago, I remember making some kind of a wiseacre remark as we looked east across the channel in the direction of France. I was standing there with our tour guide. I was there with a musical group, and we were on a tour of that part of England. And I said something to the effect of, "We're close enough to smell them." And my English host turned and looked at me, and in a moment of completely un-British bonhomie said, "I like you." The subtext being, "I like you because you don't like the French." Actually, I don't mind the French one bit. It's the governing class in France I don't like a whole lot. The same thing is true of the governing class anywhere, quite frankly. But one of the things that is part of the folk culture of England, or any place where you find Francophobes, and it seems to be most places, is that the reason why the French develop perfume is because the French don't bathe. And here you have the future King of England urging Britain to become more French in that respect, I suppose, by snubbing the tub. And he's doing this, of course, because he subscribes to the religion of biocentric environmentalism. He would someday become the defender of the faith, meaning the Anglican Church, the state church of England. But he is wildly syncretistic in his religious outlook. And the one thing that really stirs his religious devotion is the ersatz collectivist doctrine of environmentalism. It doesn't surprise me to find out that in England, for many years, you've been tagged literally as an eco-criminal for throwing out too much garbage. What you would do with that garbage, I don't know. That reminds me of the old Steve Martin routine about his guru, who gave him the immensely practical advice that he should always keep a trash bag in his car, so that when it gets filled up, he can just throw the trash bag out the window. Well, that's sort of the logic of recycling, quite frankly, because most of this stuff, if it's not usable in an economically feasible way, just gets thrown out anyway. Some cities in England, okay, I read that. Cleveland officials want to automate nearly all residential waste collection under a program being financed in part by a new fee that went into effect earlier this year. The automated trucks allow drivers to remain in the cab and empty carts using a remote control arm. Cleveland owns three of these trucks and plans to buy nine more. Recycling is good for the environment and the city's bottom line, officials said. Well, the latter is true to the extent that the term city refers to the government afflicting Cleveland. The former is very, very disputable. Cleveland pays $30 a ton to dump garbage in landfalls, but earns $26 a ton for recyclables. If that's the case, why don't they create, if they're going to be involved in this at all, why don't they create a system in which there's an economic incentive for people to recycle? Why don't they create a system where there's some incentive? For instance, if you're going to make money recycling, why don't you offer some kind of a rebate to those who recycle? Assuming, of course, that there's going to be a government role in this at all, and I'm indulging for the nonce that assumption for the purposes of this discussion. Why not create a system in which people would get a rebate or some kind of a tax credit for recycling, rather than fining them if they don't? And the answer is, their minds don't work that way, because that might involve individual liberty. And that is not the universe they inhabit. City Council approved updated trash collection ordinances last month to include a section on automated waste collection and curbside recycling. The new law changes infractions of the law from a minor misdemeanor to a civil penalty. The recycling law only applies to residents who have been issued the carts. That's interesting. How are they going to determine who gets the carts? They're going to have some kind of a lottery? A reverse lottery, I guess it would be. The losers are selected by lottery, sort of like the old draft lottery. The new law also prohibits people from setting out excessive amounts of trash on tree lawns, which officials say has been an ongoing problem. Fines for excessive trash will range from $250 to $500, depending on the amount. In either case, the property owner receives the citation. Landlords are responsible for making sure their tenants follow the law. By the way, I absolutely hate any system in which somebody who is a property owner or a business owner is suborned into becoming an enforcement agent for the government. Just about every employer is a tax collector for the government. And of course, under Obamacare, every employer is going to become, to a certain extent, an enforcer of socialized medicine. And here you have an example of landlords being used as enforcers of this eco-socialist ritual in Cleveland. Owen said Cleveland will conduct a public service campaign to educate residents. Oh, how I hate that expression. To educate residents about the new collection system and recycling program. This is what we have ordained regarding how you will live. The city stepped up enforcement of ordinances governing trash collection last year by issuing 2,900 tickets, nearly five times more tickets than in 2008. Those infractions include citations for people who put their trash out too early or failed to bring in their garbage cans from the curb in a timely manner. All they're doing is they're shaking people down to see what loose change they can take out of their pockets in the course of a depression. That's all this is, you know, coupled with the veneer of sanctimonious eco-socialist, or they call it eco-socialist sanctimony is a better way of putting that. Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network, 866-986-6397. We'll be back at you in a minute. Here's something that I find utterly predictable and perfectly nauseating. Roger Clemens might go to prison for supposedly lying to Congress. Now, I don't particularly like Roger Clemens, never really have. As a matter of fact, I don't think I've ever liked Roger Clemens in any way, shape, or form. Gotta admit, the guy had some skills. But he was apparently insufferable. And as time began pilfering his remarkable skills, like so many others in professional athletics, Mr. Clemens turned to the pharmacopoeia to supplement that which nature was taking away from him. I can't remember who it was. Might have been a poet, might have been a sports writer, more likely a poet than a sports writer, who said that the real tragedy of professional sports is that it offers, in a very compressed way, an overview of mortality, because the professional mortality of an athlete, the career mortality of a professional athlete, comes in a very, very short time frame. Sometimes it's very dramatic, too. I think of how quickly some of my favorite baseball players lost their skills. You take a look at Willie Mays. I mean, Willie Mays was probably, in my opinion, the finest baseball player who ever lived. One of the smartest baseball players who ever lived as well. He had really an incomparable combination of native athletic skills, a demonic work ethic, and a really sharp, acute intellect for the game. When he was called up in 1951 from the Milwaukee Farm Club to the New York Giants, he was hitting .477, and he didn't think that he was doing well enough to play in the majors. But just a week or so before he was called up, he had a line drive that went through the left center field fence at the minor league ballpark in Milwaukee. It went through the wall. This wasn't a chain link fence. This wasn't a picket fence. This was a wall. This was a wooden wall, probably a couple of inches thick. He hit a baseball so hard, it went through the darn wall. They had to stop the game while the umpires decided how many bases he was entitled to. Is this a ground rule double? Is this a home run? What is this? After the game, the groundskeepers took a look at this wall, and rather than fixing it, they drew a circle around it. Okay, now, that's how good this guy was. I remember watching the 1988 World Series and being impressed in game two of that series. That was the only game that the very favored Oakland Athletics actually won. The upstart Los Angeles Dodgers took 4 out of 5 games. That Sunday night, game two was the only one that the Dodgers won, or that the Athletics won. And he had back-to-backs by the Bash brothers, Canseco and Mark McGwire, both of whom, of course, are notorious now for their own steroidal excursions. But Jose Canseco, who had probably the most impressive swing I have ever seen of any baseball player, he was an idiot, he was a moron, he wasted his skills. He could have been a Mays or a Clemente or even a Ken Griffey Jr., but he really wasted the skills that God gave him and became a celebrity when he could have become a world historic figure in baseball. It's one reason I don't like the guy a whole lot. But he hit a home run to dead center field, and the ball that he hit so hard that he dented a camera, the camera in dead center field. This would have been, you know, 410, 420 feet away. And everybody was impressed by that. I was impressed by that. I remember thinking it was funny because the camera was tracking the home run and suddenly it tilted. And they showed the camera later and it had a huge dent in it. And they said, man, he really hit that thing. Yeah, he did. But you know what? Mays hit the ball harder than that. Where was I going with this? Anyhow, Willie Mays was never the same baseball player after about 1963. He had basically 12 really dominant years. And then after they moved to San Francisco, which, of course, was bad for a number of reasons, not the least of which was the fact that he was playing in Candlestick Park, which probably took a good 25 or 30 home runs, at least 25 or 30 home runs away from him. He very well might have had over 700 home runs if they had played in New York, if they'd stayed in New York rather than going to San Francisco, where the wind wrought havoc with a lot of his line drives and a lot of his fly balls, kept them in the park. And then tracking down fly balls in center field and end up in right field and end up in left field, he hated that. if he had the year and a half back that he served in the Army, he probably would have hit over 700 home runs. Chances are he might have broken Ruth's record first, but then again, Henry Aaron probably would have come along and broken his record. In any case, he had a really precipitous decline, and it was really sad by the time 68, 69 rolled around. The last real year where he looked like Willie Mays was 1971, when the Giants went to the league championship series, got beat by the Pittsburgh Pirates, and went on to take the series in 7 against Baltimore Orioles. That's one good example. Dale Murphy's another really good example. Here's a guy who was probably the best player in the major leagues until about 1987. From about 80 to 87, Dale Murphy was a world beater. There's literally nothing that guy couldn't do. And after 1987, his skills really evaporated, and nobody could really figure out why. There's something that happened in terms of his reflexes, in terms of changes in his body that came with the onset of very early middle age, and he was never the same player again. I've seen that happen time and time again. Now, Roger Clemens is one of those people who had a longer career. He managed to hold back the inevitable. It's always too short a season, if you will. The career mortality of a professional athlete's always too short a season, even if it's 20 or 25 years. If you have the preternatural longevity of a Gaylord Perry or of a George Blanda or of Carlton Fisk, it's still just too short a season for many people, or somebody like a Randy Couture in the UFC. But the thing is, Roger Clemens wanted to hold the attrition of time in abeyance just a little bit longer, and so apparently, according to at least two accounts, he ended up using performance-enhancing drugs, human growth hormone and some other concoction meant to restore to him some of what time had stolen. Time, the subtle thief of youth, as Milton put it. Milton wrote that when he was, I think, 23 years old. Boy, there's somebody who had a very foreshortened sense of mortality. According to a trainer and according to a former teammate, Andy Pettit, Roger Clemens used illicit substances. Now, Roger Clemens was given a subpoena by Congress to go and testify. So was Mark McGwire. So were a number of other players. They should have told Congress to inseminate itself. Congress has no jurisdiction over the personnel policies of Major League Baseball. This all happened about 2007, if memory serves. So they arraigned these people before Congress, where these tax-fattened popinjays sit in judgment of these men who have achieved good and worthwhile things in the crucible of human competition. These are people who have actually brought, however ephemeral it might be, a certain type of happiness to the public in peaceful pursuit of human excellence. These are people who have sacrificed and worked and tested their best against the best of other people. And you have these subsidized whoremongers reading the riot act to these guys as if they had standing to do so, either morally or constitutionally. But Roger Clemens made the mistake of allowing himself to be sworn in to offer testimony to Congress, in which he categorically denied that he had ever taken performance-enhancing drugs. His denials were contradicted by two people. Now, absent physical evidence, we've got no way to know whether Roger Clemens actually took HGH or any of these other substances. There's circumstantial evidence to suggest as much. There's eyewitness testimony. But the federal government's not going after him on a drug charge, which, by the way, the federal government doesn't have the constitutional authority to do anyway either. They're going after him for lying to Congress. Now, the potential penalty for that is 30 years in prison for lying to Congress. The thing is, Congress lies to us incessantly. Federal law enforcement officers lie to us incessantly. They can lie to you in order to entrap you. If you lie to them about conduct that isn't criminal, you can be sent to prison for lying to them about conduct that wasn't criminal. That's what happened to Martha Stewart. She wasn't sent to prison for insider trading, which, by the way, is a very dubious offense to begin with. She was sent to prison for lying to the FBI about something that wasn't a criminal act. And the same investigators had lied to her. When they do it, it's cunning law enforcement technique. If you lie to protect yourself, that's a felony. But Roger Clemens might go to prison, in spite of the fact that they're not going to be able to prove that he lied. And meanwhile, George W. Bush, who lied our country into a useless $3 trillion war that resulted in millions of deaths, he'll spend the rest of his life enjoying a taxpayer-funded pension, cocooned in taxpayer-subsidized Secret Service protection. And they call this justice. On that note, have a wonderful Lord's Day tomorrow. I'll be back in a week to resume my continued Jeremiad against the forces of collectivism. Join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com for Pro Libertate the blog. Be aware there is a PayPal button there if you want to help out. I'd sure appreciate it. Things are getting a little parlous in our household, but hopefully things will turn around for the Grigg family pretty soon. It's wonderful to be with you, and as always, Dum Spiro Pugno, while I breathe, I fight. Good night, good luck, and God bless.